He turned the shower's control level all the way over to C, rinsed off under the near-freezing needle spray, and stepped out gasping. She used one of the big towels, and as she dropped it into the hamper, she realized she felt like herself again, sane and ready to let this day go. She went to bed, and her last thought before sleep swatted her into the black was of Deputy Beckman standing watch. It was a comforting thought, particularly after her scare in the cellar, and she slept deeply, without dreams, until the shrill of the telephone woke her. 4. It was Cantata, calling from Boston. Of course it was. Darla had called her. Darla always called Canty when there was trouble, usually sooner rather than later. Canty wanted to know if she should come home. Lisi assured her sister that there was absolutely no reason to return from Boston early, no matter how distressed Darla might have sounded. Amanda was resting comfortably, and there was really nothing Canty could do. You can visit, but unless there's been a big change, which Dr. Alburn has told us not to expect, you won't be able to tell if she even knows you're there.
Jesus, Canty said. That's so awful, Lisa.
Yeah, but she's with people who understand her situation. Or understand how to care for people in her situation, at least. And Darla and I will be sure to keep you in the loop. Lisi had been pacing around the bedroom with the cordless phone. Now she stopped, staring at the notebook that had slid most of the way from the right rear pocket of her discarded blue jeans. It was Amanda's little notebook of compulsions. Only now Lisi was the one who felt compelled. Lisa? Canty was the only one who called her that on a regular basis, and it always made her feel like the sort of woman who showed off prizes on some TV game show or other. Lisa, show Hank and Martha what they've won. Lisa, are you still there?
Yeah, honey.
Eyes on the notebook, little rings gleaming in the sun, little steel loops.
I said Darla and I will be sure to keep you in the loops.
Loop. The notebook was still curved with the shape of the buttock against which it had spent so many hours, and as she looked at it, Canty's voice seemed to be fading. Lisi heard herself saying she was sure Canty would have done all the same things if she had been the one on the spot. She bent over and slipped the notebook the rest of the way out of the jeans pocket. She told Cantata she would call that evening, told Cantata she loved her, told Cantata goodbye, and tossed the cordless phone on the bed without so much as a glance. She had eyes only for the battered little notebook, 79 cents at any Walgreens or Rexall. And why should she be so fascinated? Why, now that it was morning and she was rested, clean and rested, with fresh sunshine pouring in, her compulsive search for the cedar box the night before seemed silly, nothing but a behavioral externalization of all the day's anxieties. But this notebook didn't seem silly. No, not at all. And just to add to the fun, Scott's voice spoke to her, more clearly than ever. God, but that voice was clear. And strong. I left you a note, baby love. I left you a bool. She thought of Scott under the yum-yum tree. Scott in the weird October snow, telling her that sometimes Paul would tease him with a hard bool. But never too hard. She hadn't thought of that in years. Had pushed it away, of course, with all the other things she didn't want to think of. She'd put it behind her purple curtain. But what was so bad about this? He was never mean, Scott had said. There had been tears in his eyes, but none in his voice. His voice had been clear and steady. As always, when he had a story to tell, he meant to be heard. When I was little, Paul was never mean to me, and I was never mean to him. We stuck together. We had to. I loved him, Lisi. I loved him so. By now she had flipped past the pages of numbers. Poor Amanda's numbers, all crammed madly together. She found nothing but blank pages beyond. Lisi thumbed through them faster and faster, her certainty that there was something here to find waning, then reached a page near the end with a single word printed on it. Hollyhocks. Why was that familiar? At first it wouldn't come, and then it did. What's my prize? She'd asked the thing in Amanda's nightgown. The thing turned away from her. A drink, it had said. A Coke? An RC? She had asked. And it had said.
It said, She or he said, "Shut up, we want to watch the hollyhocks," Lizzie murmured.
Yes, that was right, or almost right. Close enough for government work, anyway.
It meant nothing to her, and yet it almost did. She stared at the word a moment or two longer, then thumbed through to the end of the notebook. All the pages were blank. She was about to toss it aside when she saw ghostly words behind the last page. She flipped it up and found this printed on the bent inner surface of the notebook's back cover. Fourth station, look under the bed. But before bending to look under the bed, Lisi flipped first back to the numbers at the front of the book and then to hollyhocks, which she had found half a dozen pages from the end, confirming what she already knew. Amanda printed her fours with a right angle and a downward slash, as they had been taught in grammar school. It was Scott who had made fours that looked a little like an ampersand. It had been Scott who looped his O's together and had been in the habit of drawing a line under his jotted notes and memos. And it had always been Amanda's habit to print in tiny capitals, with slightly lazy round letters, C's, G's, Y's, and S's. Lisi flipped back and forth between hollyhocks and fourth station, look under the bed. She thought that if she put the two writing samples in front of Darla and Canty, they would without hesitation identify the former as Amanda's work and the latter as Scott's. The thing in the bed with her yesterday morning. It sounded like both of them, she whispered. Her flesh was creeping. She hadn't realized flesh could actually do that. People would call me crazy, but it really did sound like both of them. Look under the bed. At last, she did as the note instructed, and the only bool she spied was an old pair of carpet slippers. 5. Lisi Landon sat in a bar of morning sun with her legs crossed at the shins and her hands resting on the balls of her knees. She had slept nude and sat that way now. The shadow of the shears drawn across the east window lay on her slim body like the shadow of a stocking. She looked again at the note directing her to the fourth station of the bool. A short bool, a good bool. A few more and she'd get her prize. Sometimes Paul would tease me with a hard bool, but never too hard. Never too hard. With that in mind, she closed the notebook with a snap and looked at the back cover. There, written in tiny dark letters below the Denison trade name, was this. Mein Gott. Lisi got to her feet and quickly began to dress. 6. The tree closes them in their own world. Beyond is the snow. And under the yum-yum tree is Scott's voice, Scott's hypnotic voice. And did she think Empty Devils was his horror story? This is his horror story, and except for his tears when he speaks of Paul and how they hung together through all that cutting and terror and blood on the floor, he tells it unfalteringly.
We never had bool hunts when Daddy was home, he says, only when he was at work.
Scott has for the most part gotten the Western Pennsylvania accent out of his talk, but now it creeps in, far deeper than her own Yankee accent, and somehow childish. Not home, but hum. Not work, but a strange distortion that comes out, rurk.
Paul would always put the first one close by. It might say 5 stations of the bool to tell you how many clues there were, and then something like, go look in the closet. The first one was only sometimes a riddle, but the others almost always were. I remember one that said, go where Daddy kicked the cat. And of course, that was the old well. Another one said, go where we farm all day. And after a bit, I figured out that meant the old farm all tractor down in Eastfield by the rock wall. And sure enough, there was a station of the bool right there, on the seat, held down with the rock. Because a station of the bool was only a scrap of paper, you know, written on and folded over. I almost always got the riddles, but if I was stuck, Paul would give me more clues till I solved it. And at the end I'd get my prize of a Coke or an RC Cola or a candy bar. He looks at her. Beyond him is nothing but white, a wall of white. The yum-yum tree, it is actually a willow, bends around them in a magic circle, shutting out the world. He says, sometimes when Daddy got the bad gunky, cutting himself wasn't enough to let it out, Lisi. One day when he was like that, he put me...
7. Up on the bench in the hall. That was what he had said next. She could remember it now, whether she wanted to or not. But before she could follow the memory deeper into the purple where it had been hidden all this time, she saw a man standing on her back porch stoop. And it was a man, not a lawnmower or a vacuum cleaner, but an actual man. Luckily, she had time to register the fact that, although he wasn't Deputy Beckman, he was also dressed in Castle County khaki. This saved her the embarrassment of screaming like Jamie Lee Curtis in a Halloween movie. Her visitor introduced himself as Deputy Alston. He had come to fetch away the dead cat in Lisey's freezer, and also to assure her that he would be checking on her throughout the day. He asked if she had a cell phone, and Lisey said she did. It was in the BMW, and she thought it might even be working. Deputy Alston suggested she keep it with her at all times, and that she program the sheriff's office into the speed dial directory. He saw her expression and told her he was prepared to do that for her if she was not conversant with that feature. Lisey, who rarely used the little cell phone at all, led Deputy Alston to her BMW. The gadget turned out to be only half charged, but the cord was in the console compartment between the seats. Deputy Alston reached out to unplug the cigarette lighter, saw the light scattering of ashes around it, and paused. "Go ahead," Lisey told him. "I thought I was going to take up the habit again, but I guess I've changed my mind."
"Probably wise, ma'am," Deputy Alston said, unsmiling.
He removed the Beamer's cigarette lighter and plugged it in the phone. Lisey had had no idea you could do that. When she thought of it at all, she'd always recharged the little Motorola phone in the kitchen. 2 years, and she still hadn't quite gotten used to the idea that there was no man around to read the instructions and puzzle out the meanings of Fig 1 and Fig 2. She asked Deputy Alston how long the charging up would take.
"To full? No more than an hour, maybe less. Will you be within reach of a telephone in the meantime?"
"Yes, I've got some things to do in the barn. There's one there."
"Fine. Once this one's charged, clip it to your belt, or hang it on the waistband of your pants. Any cause for alarm, hit the one key and bam, you're talking to a cop."
"Thank you."
"Don't mention it. And as I said, I'll be checking on you. Dan Beckman will make this his 20 again tonight, unless he has to roll on a call. That'll probably happen. Small towns like this, Friday nights or busy nights. But you've got your phone and your speed dial, and he'll always return here."
"That's fine. Have you heard anything at all about the man who's been bothering me?"
"Not boo, ma'am,"
Deputy Alston said, comfortably enough. But of course he could afford to be comfortable. No one had threatened to hurt him, and quite likely no one would. He stood approximately 6'5" and probably weighed 250 pounds.
"Might go 175 dressed and hung," her father might have added.
In Lisbon, Dandy de Buscher had been known for such witticisms.
"If Andy hears anything, Deputy Clutterbuck, I mean, he's running things until Sheriff Ridgewick gets back from his honeymoon. I'm sure he'll let you know right away. All you have to do in the meantime is take a few sensible precautions. Door's locked when you're inside, right? Especially after dark."
"Right."
"And keep that phone handy."
"I will." He gave her a thumbs up and smiled when she gave it right back.
"I'll just go on and get that kitty now. Bet you'll be glad to see the last of it."
"Yes," Lisey said, but what she really wanted to be rid of, at least for the time being, was Deputy Alston. So she could go out to the barn and check under the bed. The one that had spent the last 20 years or so sitting in a whitewashed chicken pen. The one they had bought, mein Gott, in Germany. In Germany where... 8. Everything that can go wrong does go wrong. Lisey doesn't remember where she heard this phrase, and of course it doesn't matter, but it occurs to her with increasing frequency during their 9 months in Bremen. Everything that can go wrong does go wrong. Everything that can does. The house on Bergenstrasse Ring Road is drafty in the fall, cold in the winter, and leaky when the damp and hungover excuse for a spring finally comes. Both showers are bulky. The downstairs toilet is a chuckling horror. The landlord makes promises, then stops taking Scott's calls. Finally, Scott hires a firm of German lawyers at a paralyzing expense. Mostly, he tells Lisi, because he cannot stand to let the son of a bitching landlord get away with it. Cannot stand to let him win. The son of a bitching landlord, who sometimes winks at Lisi in a knowing way when Scott isn't looking. She has never dared tell Scott, who has no sense of humor when it comes to the son of a bitching landlord. Does not win. Under threat of legal action, he makes some repairs. The roof stops leaking, and the downstairs toilet stops its horrible midnight laughter. He actually replaces the furnace. A blue-eyed miracle. Then he shows up one night drunk and screams at Scott in a mixture of German and English, calling Scott the American Communist Boiling Potter, a phrase her husband treasures to the end of his days. Scott, far from sober himself, in Germany Scott and sober rarely even exchanged postcards, at one point offers the son of a bitching landlord a cigarette and tells him, goen Sie on, mein Führer, bitte, bitte. That year Scott is drinking, Scott is joking, and Scott is sicking lawyers on son-of-a-bitching landlords. But Scott isn't writing. Not writing because he's always drunk or always drunk because he's not writing? Lisi doesn't know. It's sixenza of one, half a dozenza of the other. By May, when his teaching gig finally, mercifully ends, she no longer cares. By May, she only wants to be someplace where conversation in the supermarket or the shops along the high street doesn't sound to her like the mammals in that movie, The Island of Dr. Moreau. She knows that's not fair, but she also knows she hasn't been able to make a single friend in Bremen, not even among the faculty wives who speak English, and her husband is gone too much at the university. She spends too much time in the drafty house, wrapped in a shawl but still usually cold. Almost always lonely and miserable, watching television programs she doesn't understand, and listening to trucks rumble around the rotary up the hill. The big ones, the Peugeots, make the floors shake. The fact that Scott is also miserable, that his classes are going badly and his lectures are near disasters, doesn't help at all. Why in God's name would it? Whoever said misery loves company was full of shite. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong, however. That guy was on to something. When Scott is at home, he's in her eye a great deal more than she's used to, because he's not crawling off to the grim little room that's been designated his study to write stories. He tries to write them at first, but by December his efforts have become sporadic, and by February he's given up entirely. The man who can write in a Motel 6, with 8 lanes of traffic pounding by outside and a frat party going on upstairs, has come utterly and completely unstrepensy. But he doesn't brood about it, not that she can see. Instead of writing, he spends long, hilarious, and ultimately exhausting weekends with his wife. Often she drinks with him, and gets drunk with him, because other than fuck him, it's all she can think of to do. There are blue hungover Mondays when Lisi is actually glad to see him going out the door. Although when 10 p.m. comes and he's still not back, she's always perched by the living room window that looks out on the ring road, waiting anxiously for the least Audi he drives, wondering where he is and who he's drinking with. How much he's drinking. There are Saturdays when he persuades her to play strenuous games of hide-and-seek with him in the big drafty house. He says it will keep them warm, at least, and he's right about that. Or they will chase each other, racing up and down stairs or pounding along the halls in their ridiculous lederhosen, laughing like a pair of dopey, not to mention horny, kids, yelling out their German buzzwords, Achtung, and Jawohl, and Ich habe Kopfschmerzen, and, most frequently, Mein Gott. More often than not, these silly games end in sex. With booze or without it, but usually with. Scott always wants sex that winter and spring, and she believes that before they vacate the drafty house on the Bergenstrasse, they have done it in all of the rooms, most of the bathrooms, including the one with the hideous laughing toilet, and even some of the closets. All that sex is one of the reasons that she never, well, almost never, worries that he's having an affair, in spite of the long hours he's gone, in spite of the hard drinking, in spite of the fact that he's not doing what he was made to do, which is to write stories.
But of course she's not doing what she was made to do either, and there are times when that knowledge catches up to her. She can't say he lied to her, or even misdirected her. No, she can never say that. He only told her once, but that one time he was perfectly straight about it. There could be no kids. If she felt she had to have children, and he knew she came from a big family, then they couldn't get married. It would break his heart, but if that was how she felt, that was the way it would have to be. He told her that under the yum-yum tree, where they'd sat enclosed in the strange October snow. She only permits herself to remember that conversation during the lonely weekday afternoons in Bremen, when the sky always seems to be white and the hour none, and the trucks rumble endlessly and the bed shakes beneath her. The bed that he bought and will later insist on having shipped back to America. Often she lies there with her arm over her eyes, thinking that this was a really terrible idea in spite of their laughing weekends and their passionate, sometimes febrile, lovemaking. They have done things in that lovemaking that she wouldn't have credited even 6 months ago. And Lisi knows these variations have little to do with love. They're about boredom, homesickness, booze, and the blues. His drinking, always heavy, has now begun to scare her. She sees the inevitable crash coming if he doesn't pull back, and the emptiness of her womb has begun to depress her. They made a deal, yeah, sure, but under the yum-yum tree, she didn't fully understand that the years pass and time has weight. He may begin to write again when they get back to America, but what will she do? He never lied to me, she thinks, as she lies on the Bremen bed with her arm over her eyes. But she sees a time, and not all that distant, when this fact will no longer satisfy, and the prospect frightens her. Sometimes she wishes she had never sat under that smucking willow with Scott Landon. Sometimes she wishes she had never met him at all. 9. That's not true, she whispered to the shadowy barn, but she felt the dead weight of his study above her as a denial. All those books, all those stories, all that gone life. She didn't repent her marriage, but yes, sometimes she did wish she had never met her troubling and troublesome man, had met someone else instead. A nice, safe computer programmer, for instance. A fellow who made $70,000 a year and would have given her 3 children, 2 boys and a girl, 1 by now grown up and married, 2 still in school. But that was not the life she had found, or the one that had found her. Instead of turning immediately to the Bremen bed, that seemed too much too soon, Lisi turned to her pathetic little excuse for an office, opened the door, and surveyed it. What had she meant to do in here while Scott wrote his stories upstairs? She couldn't remember, but knew what had drawn her here now. The answering machine. She looked at the red 1 glowing in the window with unplayed messages printed beneath it, and wondered if she should call Deputy Alston to listen. She decided not to. If it was Dooley, she could play it for him later. Of course it's Dooley. Who else? She steeled herself for more threats delivered in that calm, superficially reasonable voice, and pushed play. A moment later, a young woman named Emma was explaining the really extraordinary savings Lisi could enjoy by switching to MCI. Lisi killed this rapturous message in mid-flow, pushed erase, and thought, so much for women's intuition. She left the office laughing. 10. Lisi looked at the swaddled shape of the Bremen bed with neither sorrow nor nostalgia. Although she supposed she and Scott had made love in it, or fucked anyway, she couldn't remember how much actual love there had been during Scott and Lisi in Germany, hundreds of times. Hundreds? Was that possible during a mere 9-month stretch, especially when there had been days, sometimes whole working weeks, when she didn't see him from the time he sleepwalked out the door at 7 a.m. with his briefcase banging his knee, to the time he shuffled back in, usually half-lit, at 10 p.m. or 10:45? Yes, she supposed it was, if you spent whole weekends having what Scott sometimes called smuckaramas. Why would she hold any affection for this silent, sheeted monstrosity, no matter how many times they had bounced on it? She had better cause to hate it,
because she understood in some way that wasn't intuitive but was rather the working of subconscious logic. Lisi's smart as the devil, as long as she doesn't think about it, she once overheard Scott telling someone at a party, and she hadn't known whether to feel flattered or ashamed. That their marriage had almost broken in that bed. Never mind how nasty fine the sex had been, or that he'd fucked her to effortless multiple orgasms and tossed her salad until she thought she might go out of her mind from the nerve-popping pleasure of it. Never mind the place she'd found, the one she could touch before he came, and sometimes he'd just shudder, but sometimes he'd scream, and that made her go goosebumps all over. Even when he was deep inside her and as hot as, well, as hot as a suck oven. She thought it was right the goddamn thing should be shrouded like an enormous corpse, because, in her memory at least, everything that had occurred between them there had been wrong and violent, one chokehold shake after another on the throat of their marriage. Love? Make love? Maybe. Maybe a few times. Mostly what she remembered was one ugly fuck after another. Choke and let go. Choke and let go. And every time it took longer for the thing that was Scott and Lisi to breathe again. Finally, they left Germany. They took the QE2 back to New York from Southampton, and on the second day out, she had come back from a walk on the deck and had paused outside their stateroom with her key in her hand, head tilted, listening. From inside had come the slow but steady click of his typewriter, and Lisi had smiled. She wouldn't allow herself to believe it was all right, but standing outside that door and hearing his resumption, she had known it could be. And it was. When he told her he'd made arrangements to have what he called the Mein Gott bed shipped stateside, she had said nothing, knowing that they would never sleep in it or make love in it again. If Scott had suggested they do so, just once, little Lisi, for old time's sake, she would have refused. In fact, she would have told him to go smuck himself. If ever there was a haunted piece of furniture, it was this one. She approached it, dropped to her knees, swept back the hem of the drop cloth that covered it, and peered beneath. And there, in that musty, enclosed space where the smell of old chicken shit had come creeping back, like a dog to its vomit, she thought, was what she had been looking for. There, in the shadows, was good Ma de Buscher's cedar box. Chapter 8, Lisi and Scott, Under the Yum-Yum Tree. 1. She had no more than entered her sunny kitchen with the cedar box clasped in her arms when the phone began to ring. She put the box on the table and answered with an absent hello, no longer fearing Jim Dooley's voice. If it was him, she would just tell him she had called the police and then hang up. She was currently too busy to be scared. It was Darla, not Dooley, calling from the Green Lawn Visitor's Lounge, and Lisi wasn't exactly surprised to find that Darla had the guilts about calling Canty in Boston. And if it had been the other way around, Canty in Maine and Darla in Boston, Lisi thought it would have been about the same deal. She didn't know how much Canty and Darla still loved each other, but they still used each other the way drunks used the booze. When they were kids, Goodma used to say that if Cantata caught the flu, Darlana ran her fever. Lisi tried to make all the right responses, just as she had earlier while on the phone with Canty, and for exactly the same reason, so she could get past this shite and go on with her business. She supposed she would come back to caring about her sisters later. She hoped so. But right now, Darla's guilty conscience mattered as little to her as Amanda's gorked-out state. As little as Jim Dooley's current whereabouts come to that. As long as he wasn't in the room with her, waving a knife. No, she assured Darla, she hadn't been wrong to call Canty. Yes, she had been right to tell Canty to stay put down there in Boston. And yes, indeed, Lisi would be up to visit Amanda later on that day. It's horrible, Darla said, and in spite of her own preoccupation, Lisi heard the misery in Darla's voice. She's horrible. Then immediately in a rush, I don't mean that. She's not, of course, she's not. But it's horrible to see her. She only sits there, Lisi. The sun was hitting the side of her face when I was in, the morning sun, and her skin looks so gray and old.
Take it easy, hon, Lisi said, running the tips of her fingers over the smooth, lacquered surface of Goodma's box. Even closed, she could smell its sweetness. When she opened it, she would bend forward into that aroma, and it would be like inhaling the past. They're feeding her through a tube, Darla said. They put it in and then take it out. If she doesn't start to eat on her own, I suppose they'll just leave it in all the time. She gave a huge, watery sniff. They're feeding her through a tube, and she's already so thin, and she won't talk. And I spoke to a nurse who said sometimes they go on this way for years. Sometimes they never come back. Oh, Lisi, I don't think I can stand it. Lisi smiled a little at this as her fingers moved to the hinges at the back of the box. It was a smile of relief. Here was Darla the drama queen, Darla the diva, and that meant they were back on safe ground. Two sisters with well-worn scripts in hand. At one end of the wire is Darla the sensitive. Give her a hand, ladies and gentlemen. At the other end, little Lisi, small but tough. Let's hear it for her.
I'll be up this afternoon, Darla, and I'll have another talk with Dr. Albernus. They'll have a clearer picture of her condition by then.
Darla, doubtful.
Do you really think so?
Lisi, with no smucking idea.
Absolutely. And what you need is to go home and put your feet up. Maybe take a nap.
Darla, in tones of dramatic proclamation.
Oh, Lisi, I could never sleep.
Lisi didn't care if Darla ate, busted a joint, or took a shit in the begonias. She just wanted to get off the phone.
Well, you come on back, honey, and take it easy for a little while anyway. I have to get off the phone. I've got something in the oven.
Darla was instantly delighted.
Oh, Lisi, you?
Lisi found this extremely annoying, as if she had never cooked anything more strenuous in her life than, well, hamburger helper.
Is it banana bread?
Close. Cranberry bread. I've got to go check it.
But you'll be coming to see Manda later, right?
Lisi felt like screaming. Instead, she said,
right, this afternoon.
Well, then.
Doubt was back. Convince me, it said. Stay on the phone another 15 minutes or so and convince me.
I guess I'll come on home.
Good deal. Bye, Darl.
And you really don't think I was wrong to call Candy?
No, call Bruce Springsteen, call Hal Holbrook, call Condi Smucking Rice, just leave me alone.
Not at all. I think it's good that you did. Keep her...
Lisi thought of Amanda's little notebook of compulsions.
Keep her in the loop, you know? Well, okay. Goodbye, Lisi. I guess I'll see you later.
Bye, Darl. Click. At last. Lisi closed her eyes, opened the box, and inhaled the strong scent of cedar. For a moment, she allowed herself to be five again, wearing a pair of Darla's hand-me-down shorts and her own scuffed but beloved Little Rider cowboy boots, the ones with the faded pink swoops up the sides. Then she looked into the box to see what there was and where it would take her.
2. On top was a foil packet, 6 or 8 inches long, maybe 4 inches wide and 2 inches deep. Two lumps poked out of it, rounding the foil. She didn't know what it was as she lifted it out, caught a ghostly whiff of peppermint. Had she been smelling it already, along with the cedar scent of the box? And remembered, even before she unfolded one side and saw the rock-hard slice of wedding cake. Embedded in it were two plastic figures, a boy doll in morning coat and top hat, a girl doll in a white wedding dress. Lisi had meant to save this for a year and then share it with Scott on their first anniversary. Wasn't that the superstition? If so, she should have put it in the freezer. Instead, it had wound up here. Lisi chipped off a piece of the frosting with her nail and put it in her mouth. It had almost no taste, just a ghost of sweetness and a last fading whisper of peppermint. They had been married in the Newman Chapel at the University of Maine in a civil ceremony. All of her sisters had come, even Jody. Lincoln, dead Busher's surviving brother, came up from Sebattis to give away the bride. Scott's friends from Pitt and UMO had been there, and his literary agent had done the best man honors. No Landon family, of course. Scott's family was dead. Below the petrified slice of cake was a pair of wedding invitations. She and Scott had handwritten them, each doing half,
and she had saved one of Scott's and one of her own. Below those was a souvenir matchbook. They had discussed having both the invitations and the matchbooks printed. It was an expense they probably could have managed, even though the money from the Empty Devil's paperback sale hadn't begun to flow yet. But in the end, they had decided on handmade as more intimate, not to mention funkier. She remembered buying a 50-count box of plain paper matches at the Cleves Mills IGA and hand-lettering them herself, using a red pen with a fine-point ball. The matchbook in her hand was quite likely the last of that tribe, and she examined it with the curiosity of an archaeologist and the ache of a lover. Scott and Lisa Landon, November 19th, 1979. Now we are two. Lisa felt tears prick her eyes. Now we are two had been Scott's idea. He said it was a riff on a Winnie the Pooh title. She remembered the one he meant at once. How many times had she pestered either Jadotha or Amanda into reading her away to the Hundred Acre Wood? And thought, now we are two was brilliant, perfect. She had kissed him for it. Now she could hardly bear to look at the matchbook with its foolishly brave motto. This was the other end of the rainbow. Now she was one, and what a stupid number it was. She tucked the matchbook away in the breast pocket of her blouse and then wiped tears from her cheeks. Some few had spilled after all. It seemed investigating the past was wet work. What's happening to me? She would have given the price of her pricey beamer and more to know the answer to that question. She had seemed so all right, had mourned him and gone on. Had put away her weeds and gone on. For over 2 years now, the old song seemed to be true. I get along without you very well. Then she had begun the work of cleaning out his study, and that had awakened his ghost, not in some ethery out there spirit world, but in her. She even knew when and where it had begun. At the end of the first day, in that not quite triangular corner Scott liked to call his memory nook. That was where the literary awards hung on the wall, citations under glass, his National Book Award, his Pulitzer for Fiction, his World Fantasy Award for Empty Devils. And what had happened? I broke, Lisa said in a small, frightened voice, and sealed the foil back over the fossilized slice of wedding cake. There was no other word for it. She broke. Her memory of it wasn't terribly clear, only that it started because she was thirsty. She went to get a glass of water in that stupid smucking bar alcove, stupid because Scott no longer used the booze, although his adventures with alcohol had lasted years longer than his love affair with the smokes. And the water wouldn't come. Nothing came but the maddening sound of chugging pipes blowing up blasts of air. And she could have waited for the water. It would have come eventually. But instead, she turned off the faucets and went back to the doorway between the alcove and the so-called memory nook, and the overhead light was on, but it was the kind on a rheostat and dialed low. With the light like that, everything looked normal, everything the same, haha. You almost expected him to open the door from the outside stairway, walk in, crank up the tunes, and start to write. Just like he hadn't come unstrapped forever. And what had she expected to feel? Sadness? Nostalgia? Really? Something as polite, as dear, dear lady, as nostalgia? If so, that was a real knee-slapper, because what had come over her then, both fever-hot and freezing cold, was... 3. What comes over her? Practical Lisa. Lisa, who always stays cool, except maybe on the day she had to swing the silver spade, and even on that day she flatters herself that she did okay. Little Lisa, who keeps her head when all those about her are losing theirs. What comes over her is a kind of seamless and bulging rage, a divine fury that seems to push her mind aside and take control of her body. Yet, she doesn't know if this is a paradox or not. This fury also seems to clarify her thinking, must, because she finally understands. 2 years is a long time, but the penny finally drops. She gets the picture. She sees the light. He has kicked the bucket, as the saying is. Do you like it?
He has popped off. Do you love it? He is eating a dirt sandwich. It's a big one I caught in the pool where we all go down to drink and fish.
And when you boil it down, what's left?
Why, he has jilted her. Done a runner. Put an egg in his shoe and beat it. Hit the road, Jack. Took the midnight special out of town. He lit out for the territories. He left the woman who loved him with every cell in her body and every brain in her not-so-smart head. And all she has is this shitty, smucking shell. She breaks. Lisi breaks. As she bolts forward into his stupid, smucking memory nook, she seems to hear him saying, "Sweeza, baby love, strap on whenever it seems appropriate." And then that is gone, and she begins tearing his plaques and pictures and framed citations from the walls. She picks up the bust of Lovecraft, the World Fantasy Award judges gave him for Empty Devils, that hateful book, and throws it the length of the study, screaming, "Fuck you, Scott! Fuck you!"
It's one of the few times she's used the word in its unvarnished form since the night he put his hand through the greenhouse glass, the night of the blood bowl. She was angry with him then, but never in her life has she been so angry with him as she is now. If he were here, she might kill him all over again. She's on a full-bore rampage, tearing all that useless vanity crap off the walls until they are bare. Few of the things she throws down break on the floor because of the deep pile carpet. Lucky for her, she'll think later on, when sanity returns. As she whirls around and around, a tornado now for sure, she screams his name again and again. Screams Scott, and Scott, and Scott. Crying for grief, crying for loss, crying for rage. Crying for him to explain how he could leave her so. Crying for him to come back, oh, to come back. Never mind everything the same. Nothing is the same without him. She hates him. She misses him. There's a hole in her. A wind even colder than the one that blew all the way down from Yellowknife now blows through her. The world is so empty and so loveless when there's no one in it to holler your name and holler you home. At the end, she seizes the monitor of the computer that sits in the memory nook, and something in her back gives a warning creak as she lifts it, but smuck her back. The bare walls mock her, and she is raging. She spins awkwardly with the monitor in her arms and heaves it against the wall. There is a hollow, shattering noise. Poof, it sounds like. And then silence again. No, there are crickets outside. Lisi collapses to the littered carpet, sobbing weakly, all in. And does she call him back somehow? Does she call him back into her life by the very force of her angry, delayed grief? Has he come like water through a long, empty pipe? She thinks the answer to that is... 4. No, Lisi murmured. Because, crazy as it seemed... Scott seemed to have been at work placing the stations of this bull hunt for her long before he died. Getting in touch with Dr. Albernus, for instance, who happened to have been such a perfectly huge fan. Somehow laying hands on Amanda's medical records and bringing them to lunch, for heaven's sake. And then the kicker. Mr. Landon said if I ever met you, I should ask about how he fooled the nurse that time in Nashville. And... when he had put Goodma's cedar box under the Bremen bed out in the barn, because surely it had been Scott. She knew she had never put it there. 1996? Hush. In the winter of 1996, when Scott's mind had broken and she had... You hush now, Lisi. All right, all right. She would hush about the winter of 96, for now. But that felt about right. And... a bull hunt... but why? To what purpose? To allow her to face in stages something she couldn't face all at once? Maybe. Probably. Scott would know about such things, would surely sympathize with a mind that would want to hide its most terrible memories behind curtains or squirrel them away in sweet-smelling boxes. A good bull. Oh, Scott, what's good about this? What's good about all this pain and sorrow?
A short bool.
If so, the cedar box was either the end or close to the end, and she had an idea that if she looked much further, there would be no going back.
Baby, he sighed, but only in her head. There were no ghosts, only memory. Only the voice of her dead husband, she believed that. She knew it.
She could close the box, she could draw the curtain, she could let the past be past.
Baby love, he would always have his say. Even dead, he would have his say.
She sighed. It was a wretched, lonely sound to her own ears, and decided to go on. To play Pandora after all.
5.
The only other thing she'd squirreled away in here from their cut-rate, non-religious, but it had held for all that, had held very well, wedding day, was a photograph taken at the reception, which had been held at The Rock, Cleves Mill's raunchiest, rowdiest, low-down, and dirtiest rock and roll bar. It showed her and Scott out on the floor as they began the first dance. She was in her white lace dress, Scott in a plain black suit. My undertaker's suit, he called it, which he'd bought special for the occasion, and had worn again and again on the Empty Devil's book tour that winter. In the background, she could see Jadotha and Amanda, both of them impossibly young and pretty, their hair up, their hands frozen in mid-clap. She was looking at Scott, and he was smiling down at her, his hands on her waist, and, oh God, look how long his hair had been, almost brushing his shoulders, she had forgotten that. Lisi brushed the surface of the photograph with the tips of her fingers, slipping them across the people they'd been, back at Scott and Lisi, the beginning, and found she could even remember the name of the band from Boston, the Swinging Johnsons, pretty funny, and the song to which they had danced in front of their friends, a cover of Too Late to Turn Back Now by Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose.
Oh, Scott, she said.
Another tear slipped down her cheek, and she wiped it away absently. Then she put the photo on the sunny kitchen table and prospected deeper. Here was a thin stack of menus, bar napkins, and matchbooks from motels in the Midwest. Also a program from Indiana University in Bloomington announcing a reading from Empty Devils by Scott Linden. She remembered saving that one for the misprint, telling him it would be worth a fortune someday, and Scott replying, "Don't hold your breath, baby love." The date on the program was March 19, 1980. So where were her souvenirs from the Antlers? Had she taken nothing? In those days she almost always took something. It was a kind of hobby. And she could have sworn. She lifted out the Scott Linden program, and there beneath it was a dark purple menu with the Antlers and Rome, New Hampshire stamped on it in gold. And she could hear Scott as clearly as if he were speaking in her ear. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. He'd said it that night in the dining room, empty except for them and a single waitress, ordering the chef's special for both of them, and again later in bed as he covered her naked body with his own. I offered to pay for this, she murmured, holding the menu up to her sunny, empty kitchen. And the guy said I could just take it, because we were their only guests, and because of the snowstorm. That weird October snowstorm. They had stayed two nights instead of just the one that had been in the plan. And on the second, she had remained awake long after Scott had gone to sleep. Already the cold front that had brought the unusual snow was moving out, and she could hear it melting, dripping from the eaves. She had lain there in that strange bed, the first of so many strange beds she'd share with Scott, thinking about Andrew Sparky Landon and Paul Landon and Scott Landon, Scott the survivor, thinking about bools, good bools and blood bools, thinking about the purple, thinking about that too. At some point the clouds had broken open and the room had been flooded with windy moonlight. In that light she had at last fallen asleep. The next day, a Sunday, they had driven through countryside that was reverting back from winter to fall, and less than a month later they had been dancing to the Swinging Johnsons, Too Late to Turn Back Now.
She opened the gold-stamped menu to see what the chef's special had been that long-ago night, and a photograph fell out. Lisi remembered it at once. The owner of the place had taken it with Scott's little Nikon. The guy had scrounged up two pairs of snowshoes. His cross-country skis were still in storage up in North Conway, he said, along with his four snowmobiles, and insisted that Scott and Lisi take a hike along the trail behind the inn. "The woods are magical in the snow," Lisi remembered him telling them. "And you'll have them all to yourselves, not a single skier or snow machine. It's the chance of a lifetime." He had even packed them a picnic lunch with a bottle of red wine on the house. And here they were, togged out in snow pants and parkas and the earmuffs which the guy's amiable wife had found for them. Lisi's parka comically too big, the hem drooping all the way to her knees, standing for their portrait outside a country bed and breakfast in what looked like a Hollywood special effects blizzard, wearing snowshoes and grinning like a couple of cheerful nitwits. The pack Scott wore to hold their lunch and the bottle of vino was another loner. Scott and Lisi, bound for the yum-yum tree, although neither had known it then. Bound for a trip down memory lane. Only for Scott Landon, memory lane was Freak Alley, and it was no wonder he didn't choose to go there often. Still, she thought, skating the tips of her fingers over this photograph as she had over the one of their wedding dance. "You must have known you'd have to go there at least once before I married you, like it or not. You had something to tell me, didn't you? The story that would back up your one non-negotiable condition. You must have been looking for the right spot for weeks. And when you saw that tree, that willow so drooped over with snow it made a grotto inside, you knew you'd found it, and you couldn't put it off any longer. How nervous were you, I wonder? How afraid that I'd hear you out, and then tell you I didn't want to marry you after all." Lisi thought he'd been nervous, all right. She could remember his silence in the car. Hadn't she thought even then that something was on his mind? Yes, because Scott was usually so talkative. "But you must have known me well enough by then," she began, then trailed off. The nice thing about talking to yourself was that mostly you didn't have to finish what you were saying. By October 1979, he must have known her well enough to believe she'd stick. Hell, when she didn't tell him to take a hike after he cut his hand to ribbons on a pane of Park's greenhouse glass, he must have believed she was in it for the long haul. But had he been nervous about exposing those old memories, touching those ancient live wires? She guessed about that he'd been more than nervous. She guessed about that he'd been scared to smucking death. All the same, he had taken her gloved hand in one of his, pointed, and said, "Let's eat there, Lisi. Let's go under that..." 6. "Let's eat under that willow," he says. And Lisi is more than willing to fall in with this plan. For one thing, she's hugely hungry. For another, her legs, especially her calves, are aching from the unaccustomed exercise involved in using the snowshoes. Lift, twist, and shake. Lift, twist, and shake. Mostly, though, she wants a rest from looking at the ceaselessly falling snow. The walk has been every bit as gorgeous as the innkeeper promised, and the quiet is something she thinks she'll remember for the rest of her life. The only sounds the crunch of their snowshoes, the sound of their breathing, and the restless tack hammer of a far-off woodpecker. Yet the steady downpour, there is really no other word, of huge flakes has started to freak her out. It's coming so thick and fast, it's messed up her ability to focus, and that's making her feel disoriented and a little dizzy. The willow sits on the edge of a clearing, its still green fronds weighted down with thick white frosting. "Do you call them fronds?" Lisi wonders, and thinks she will ask Scott over lunch. Scott will know. She never asks. Other matters intervene. Scott approaches the willow and Lisi follows, lifting her feet and twisting them to shake off the snowshoes, walking in her fiancé's tracks. When he reaches the tree, Scott parts the snow-covered fronds, branches, whatever they are, like a curtain, and peers inside. His blue-jeaned butt is sticking out invitingly in her direction. "Lisi," he says, "this is pretty neat. Wait till you see..." She raises snowshoe A and applies it to blue-jeaned butt B,
Fiancé C promptly disappears into snow-covered willow D with a surprised curse.
It's amusing, quite amusing indeed. And Lisi begins to giggle as she stands in the pouring snow. She is coated with it. Even her eyelashes are heavy.
Lisi, from inside the drooping white umbrella.
Yes, Scott? Can you see me?
Nope, she says.
Come a little closer, then.
She does, stepping in his tracks, knowing what to expect. But when his arm shoots out through the snow-covered curtain and his hand seizes her wrist, it's still a surprise, and she shrieks with laughter because she's a bit more than startled. She's actually a little frightened. He pulls her forward, and cold whiteness dashes across her face, blinding her for a moment. The hood of her parka is back, and snow slides down her neck, freezing on her warm skin. Her earmuffs are pulled askew. She hears a muffled flump as heavy clots of snow fall off the tree behind her.
"Scott," she gasps. "Scott, you scared me."
But here she stops. He's on his knees before her, the hood of his parka pushed back to reveal a spill of dark hair that's almost as long as hers. He's wearing his earmuffs around his neck like headphones. The pack is beside him, leaning against the tree trunk. He's looking at her, smiling, waiting for her to dig it. And Lisi does. She digs it big time. Anybody would, she thinks. It's a little like being allowed in the clubhouse, where her big sister Manda and her friends played at being girl pirates. But no, it's better than that, because it doesn't smell of ancient wood and damp magazines and moldy old mouse shit. It's as if he's taken her into an entirely different world, pulled her into a secret circle, a white-roofed dome that belongs to nobody but them. It's about 20 feet across. In the center is the trunk of the willow. The grass growing out from it is still the perfect green of summer.
"Oh, Scott," she says, and no vapor comes out of her mouth.
It's warm in here, she realizes. The snow caught on the drooping branches has insulated the space beneath. She unzips her jacket.
"Neat, isn't it? Now listen to the quiet."
He falls silent. So does she. At first she thinks there's no sound at all, but that's not quite right. There's one. She can hear a slow drum muffled in velvet. It's her heart. He reaches out, strips off her gloves, takes her hands. He kisses each palm, deep in the center of the cup. For a moment, neither of them says anything. It's Lisi who breaks the silence. Her stomach rumbles. Scott bursts into laughter, falling back against the trunk of the tree and pointing at her.
"Me too," he says. "I wanted to skin you out of those snow pants and screw in here, Lisi. It's warm enough. But after all that exercise, I'm too hungry."
"Maybe later," she says. Knowing that later she'll almost certainly be too full for screwing, but that's okay. If the snow keeps up, they'll almost certainly be spending another night here at the Antlers, and that's fine with her. She opens the pack and lays out lunch. There are 2 thick chicken sandwiches, lots of mayo, salad, and 2 hefty slices of what proves to be raisin pie.
"Yum," he says as she hands him one of the paper plates.
"Of course yum," she says. "We're under the yum-yum tree." He laughs. "Under the yum-yum tree, I like it." Then his smile fades, and he looks at her solemnly. "It's nice here, isn't it?"
"Yes, Scott, very nice."
He leans over the food. She leans to meet him. They kiss above the salad. "I love you, little Lisi."
"I love you, too."
At that moment, hidden away from the world in this green and secret circle of silence, she has never loved him more. This is now. 7. Despite his profession of hunger, Scott eats only half his sandwich and a few bites of salad. The raisin pie he doesn't touch at all, but he drinks more than his share of the wine. Lisi eats with better appetite, but not quite as heartily as she thought she would. There's a worm of unease gnawing at her. Whatever has been on Scott's mind, the telling will be hard for him, and maybe even harder for her. What makes her most uneasy is that she can't think what it might be. Some kind of trouble with the law, back in the rural western Pennsylvania town where he grew up? Did he perhaps father a child? Was there maybe even some kind of teenage marriage?
A quickie job that ended in a divorce or an annulment 2 months later?
Is it Paul, the brother who died? Whatever it is, it's coming now. Sure as rain follows thunder, Goodma would have said. He looks at a slice of pie, seems to think about taking a bite, then pulls out his cigarettes and